And welcome back, everybody. We're talking with Joseph P. Farrell and Scott D. DeHart about their book Transhumanism, a Grimoire of Alchemical Agendas. And of course, before we go into talking more about the not only the future of this, but the current state of the development of the where we are when it comes to the singularity, the technology, we have projects like 2045 with the, you know, that Russian guy in charge. There's a lot of stuff going on here now. This is not just a fantasy of the future, if you will. But before we do that, though, before we go into the future and history again, I wanted to tie it back once again to some of the concepts that has to do with the alchemical marriage, etc. Some of the things that have shown about the prospects of marrying, you know, the two different opposites of masculine and feminine, etc. Today, though, what seems to be the case is that this has been turned into, I would call it a chemical baptism as opposed to an alchemical marriage. We have more things in the environment than ever that actually is transforming the human being with endocrine disruptors, bisphenol A, phthalates, you know, estrogen mimicking chemicals, and all these things that are actually upsetting the female and male balance. So have you guys looked at this at all in terms of what is being done right now with chemicals and if this ties into the transhumanist agenda ultimately?
Well, we did, Henrik, in the book, and you're right. When we were writing it, Henrik, one of our frustrations was the field was changing as fast as we were able to research and write about it. So, you know, there's a lot in the book that is already, in a certain sense, kind of passé in that sense because it doesn't represent, obviously, what's being done now. But that's kind of the reason we decided to approach this from this alchemical point of view, in that once you did, then what we write about become examples of these fusions. And, you know, just to recall what we're talking about, in the esoteric tradition, even in the Jewish Kabbalistic tradition, you get this idea of four levels or layers to the descent of man. And it starts at the top with androgyny, then it descends to mineral man, then vegetable man, and then finally animal man, which is the lowest stage, which is the stage we're in. If you look at the basic broad outline of that cosmology, you have in effect the modern cosmology, which says we start from primordial nothingness, you've got the Big Bang, you have the creation of the elements, the basic elements, and, you know, we're all basically stardust looked at a certain way. Then you have the creation of plant life, and then finally, in the big macro evolutionary scheme of things, the evolution of actual life, animal life. So in that sense, we're not looking at anything new in modern science. We're looking at something very old dressed up in modern scientific guise. Well, when we approach transhumanism, the phenomenon, what we see going on is technological fusions of humanity with things at each of those levels. We can start with your idea of environmental modifications of the masculine and feminine. We certainly find laboratories engaged with creating chimerical blends or fusions of humanity and other forms of animals. We have pigs growing human organs. We've got pigs with human blood. We've got all sorts of stuff being concocted in laboratories that are basically fusions of mankind and animals. They even call them animals. So, you know, we're not dealing with anything there. We find similar fusions of humanity and plants. We talked a great deal in the book about GMOs and their potential to modify the human organism. Which, you know, at the time we wrote, we were writing kind of ahead of the curve in that respect, because now there's a raft of papers that appear online in various sources that are talking about the dangers of GMOs and how they actually modify the organisms that they come into contact with. And in that, you'd have to include humanity. The mechanism of modification is, quite frankly, in my opinion, unknown. You know, I had an angry person write me, Henrik, after we published the book, saying, well, you know, you're talking nonsense. You don't get genetic modifications from ingesting food. Well, I know that, you know. If we did, you know, if we like bacon, we'd end up being turned into pigs. You know, you know, it's an obvious thing, but at the same time, there is a growing body of evidence that there is some sort of modification taking place by some sort of mechanism that we don't really know.
Well, of course, you know, that's kind of the danger here is that it's a live ongoing experiment and we really don't know what's going to happen, you know.
So. Exactly.
However, I think, and this is true, but when we look at the effects we see in society with the large amount of, say, growth hormone that is being fed into the animals, which is being consumed by the young people around us, just from a simple subjective observational point of view, I can look at the students that I'm teaching today as compared to students that I would have taught 20 years ago and see a complete difference in the terms of the size, the mental slowness, which is not, I think, entirely due to habits in the home. I think when I look at what is being consumed on a daily basis in large quantities, that there is an effect that is slowing down both the ability to think as well as the body to grow larger because of hormones that are being added and regularly consumed, regardless of the amount of exercise or the things that are being told to eat to change the diet. The diet simply is not changing. It's just more of the same modern modified food which is being consumed and is changing the ability to think as well as the human shape.
Now, let me add something to that, Henrik, that's very, very important here. We did not mention this in the book, although we talked about it, and we talked briefly about it, and we eventually decided to not include it because it would sidetrack people from the main thrust of the book, which is what was happening now. But if you go back and look at the cereal grains that humanity eats, you'll discover online, if you do a search for these types of things, you'll eventually come across a number of papers that various people have written that strongly suggest that even prior to the modern genetic modifications that have been made by various companies to crops, that the crops themselves were already modified so that humanity would gain some nutritional value from them. There's strong evidence that wheat, for example, non-GMO wheat, was already one such crop that was genetically modified a long time ago in order that humanity could eat it. So in other words, this idea that Scott's talking about food being a way of modifying the human being, both physiologically and in terms of mental capacity. This is not new.
No.
And it's also found in religious texts with blood being added into the crops.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's a fascinating, you know, area in itself. The chickpeas and the way they show up even in the record, it seems to be a transformation practically overnight and stuff like that. There's evidence that shows that even the, as you say, the physiology of the human being actually changes with the consumption of grains. There are, again, certain endocrine disruptors in like hops and stuff like that. It's modifying the human being, you know?
Yes, exactly. And again, this is a very ancient religious and alchemical idea, you know, the sacred food, the food of the gods that elevates you or gives you some sort of participation in the divine. You know, it's everywhere from the Vedas to...
Go ahead, Scott.
I was just going to say, you can't separate the idea of a sacred food, whether it is a sacrifice given or one consumed by the priests or the people, where there is not some sense in which there is a sacramental relationship between the person, the food, and the object to which they are giving themselves.
Yeah.
That whether one wants to say this is just pure mythology or not, we'll take it at that level, mythologically or spiritually, it is woven into the fabric of our history of humans from the very beginning.
Yeah. So, you know, it's not surprising that we have a transhumanist version of this in modern times, you know. And then just to kind of round out this alchemical agenda, Henrik, from there we go on to the fusions of man and mineral, which we took in the sense of man and machine. You know, most of our machines are made out of metals, out of minerals of some sort. And you see this over and over again in the transhumanist literature, you know, ingesting nanobots, little robots, and computer interfaces or implants, you know, in the brain to upload or download or influence emotions and what have you. So at every level, you find some sort of transhumanist equivalent of these alchemical fusions. The one that most surprised us, Henrik, is the one that Scott found at Oak Ridge National Laboratory. I'll let him tell you about that.
Yeah.
Oh, that was quite disturbing. it was one of those finds that one doesn't exactly expect to run across, but in virtue of trying to find who might be following the same line of thought that he and I were, which much of it began simply with what if questions, and then trying to find, as I think most research does, it begins in the realm of a certain hypothesis that you want to chase down, an intuitive sense of what's going on. And in the midst of tracking that down, among the things that we found going on was that the government itself was quite interested in the same thing that we were, which was how gender is related to how people think, and therefore what if one could modify it, and what would be the behaviors that are going to follow with it. And among some of the most strange things that were being researched was the relationship of, say, homosexuality to the ability to roll the tongue.
Really?
Yeah. Henrik, we were just, when he found that, he sent it to me, and we both just kind of stared at each other with our jaw open. And this was all being conducted, if I'm not mistaken, it was being conducted by the Department of Energy at Oak Ridge, and they were discussing the genetic basis of behaviors like alcoholism, like he said, the ability to roll the tongue, wiggle the ears, homosexuality, and just a very bizarre list.
Huh.
And it was right there on the government website, and we thought, holy cow, you know, if they're thinking this way, they can only possibly be thinking this way. There's no other explanation for why they'd be researching all of this stuff. It just really left us kind of in shock. But, you know, even what it goes to show is, even at that level, we're dealing in transhumanism with, you know, all four stages of the alchemical ascent back up the ladder, in some sense, either being studied or actually advocated, and in some cases even actually being done. So,
What do you think, Joseph? Is the point of studies like that to find those different kind of connections between the different properties, if you will?
Well, I go back to something that you and I have talked about on your program many, many times. I think this whole impetus to test ancient texts for their scientific content and credibility is really a very old agenda, and you can find it very clearly. And Scott and I wrote about this in that little transhumanist dialogues book that we put out as kind of a supplement. This idea of an ancient lost high civilization that is preserving its knowledge in the form of myths like this is really very old, and you find the weirdest people, you know, brilliant people. You and I have talked about Olaf Rutbeck at the University of Uppsala, that was very, very definitely in this tradition of scientific thinking about this. Certainly Newton adhered to it. Descartes, believe it or not, which really left me kind of stunned. And certainly Leibniz. So it stands to reason that you're going to have elements within the government, and we talked about this in Covert Wars and Clash of Civilizations, when we talked about that, we have an element, I think, Henrik, within the great powers of the West that has always pursued very quietly this looking at ancient texts and seeing if there was a modern sort of scientific analog. I'm convinced that this is the reason for it. And to give you, again, the clearest example of this in modern times, it would be Nazi Germany. And, you know, that whole agenda just didn't stop because the Nazis lost the war. I think at that point, pretty much everybody said, oh, looky what they were doing. We better do it too.
Exactly.
I found some of the lists, Joseph. Hand skill, relative handedness, hand clasping pattern, arm folding preference, ears ability to move. Now, mind you, this is coming out of Oak Ridge National Laboratory. Musical perfect pitch, tongue curling, folding and rolling, stuttering, novelty seeking personality trait, tobacco addiction, alcoholism, and homosexuality.
And they're looking for genetic traits of this thing.
Yes, of all of those things.
Wow. What about tongue rolling? Is that like twerking? what does that mean?
Back to modern schools, yes.
Oh, God. Jesus.
What caused us to take a step back on that research was our own thoughts along the line, which was, if we are putting things such as hand clasping, arm folding preference, tobacco addiction, and then homosexuality together in the same study, what traits are they looking for?
Perfect pitch.
Right. What traits do they expect to find joined together in this? And if they could isolate those, is the goal then to manipulate, remove, or to make use of? Because this is coming out of a study where the point of just identifying traits is much more than just information gathering. And when you apply that towards what's happening in the laboratories, what is it that is distinctive about gender studies from the 19th century to the present time, which began to become very identifying for personality types, creativeness, intelligence, or the ability to use both sides of the brain in a way that perhaps gives an advantage to somebody over somebody else.
Right.
And then how might you be able to apply that in terms of either control of the individual or use perhaps even far more insidious on the battlefield?
So, and there's nothing that's distinctive of like who's, as you say, who the reasons why they're looking for these traits for being pro or con. The information that's available is just that this is what we looked for. And
exactly.
Did they have any results on this as well then? Or
no.
No. All we found, Henrik, was that they were looking at these things. There was no indication as to whether or not they thought any of these things were good or bad. The only thing that is a mild indicator that they might be thinking that these are negative things is the inclusion of alcoholism in that list.
Mm-hmm.
But you remove that and then look at the rest of the list, and there's really nothing in the list itself that gives you any sort of indicator that they're making moral judgments. So, no, it's just a list. It's just a very weird list.
Yeah. Or they're looking for a few things, but they're blending it together with many or something like that.
It could be. Who knows?
Yeah.
It's just very curious that Oak Ridge National Laboratory, you know, which falls under the Department of Energy, which conducts, you know, some very classified research.
And by the way, before we proceed, Department of Energy are the ones who are in charge of the Human Genome Project, by the way.
That's precisely it.
Yeah.
Yes. Bingo. Bingo.
And this is,
so, you know.
Yeah, closely related to the studies that are being conducted in laboratories, even throughout California here, where you have embryos being created in a particular choice so that they can harvest, say, stem cells. And what traits are they trying to identify, or what things are they intending to use with it, is just what makes it perhaps a little bit more of an eyebrow raising moment.
Well, exactly. Let's talk about that a little bit in terms of the what we can see in the development of artificial production, I guess we could say, of human life. Artificial sperm, artificial wombs. We have infertility on the rise. There's a number of things that if you begin to piece it together, you realize that, okay, they might literally be trying to create a human being in a lab, and they might even potentially want to have that human being to have certain genetic traits, you know, for different reasons. So if we put all this together, how concerned should we be about this when it comes to infertility and the development of artificial life? Because ultimately, can you guys imagine what a legal framework would be set up around the production of such an quote-unquote individual, you know?
Well, this was some of the most disconcerting matters that, as Joseph said, the news would come in quicker than we could write the book as soon as we had finished a section. A new one would appear to us.
Yeah.
For instance, the rearranging of a rat's brain with human cells, things that would truly create these chimeras and put them out, or even to create embryos, as at least rumor had it, and then to destroy things. Those were, at least, whether they were apocryphal or truly being done, of course, nobody can say, because it would be unethical to be doing this. But the stories that were coming out raised that problem. And Joseph has taken this, I think, in quite a deep manner with the question of ownership and manipulation.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that is where it became to us the most frightening of all, is that if you are, in fact, manipulating, changing, creating, and we then release this into society or produce it within the society that already exists by manipulating it, who holds the ownership of it? Because that has already been applied to the question of the crops, where genetic modifications have taken place, and unintentionally, those have ended up in another field, and who owns the right to them?
Yeah.
And so if you are manipulating the nature of something, and the company that owns it can claim an ownership of it, what happens to that product? Joseph, do you want to jump on that one?
Yeah. What he's talking about there, Henrik, is something that I intimated in the book Genes, Giants, Monsters, and Men. Because in American patent law, which American companies have been more or less pushing to become the standards legally internationally, they already are to a certain extent in Europe because of the similarities of the development of law in Europe and this country to begin with. But the standard is that something is patentable if it could only have arisen by the hand of man, and secondly, if it has a precise recipe that someone else can introduce to reproduce, all right? So a genetic crop, a crop that's literally created by splicing genes in a laboratory, is a patentable object that corporations like Monsanto, DuPont, you know, all the companies involved in GMOs, have a royalty right to. Now, what has happened in American law is, say a bird eats some seeds from a genetically modified crop field and, you know, defecates on another farmer's field, and the seeds start growing there. Well, these companies have sent out spies, and they have found their crops growing on other fields and taken these farmers to court, sued them for non-payment of royalties, and won.
Yeah.
All right? So now let's extend the scenario a bit. Suppose by some unknown mechanism you ingest a genetically modified food and it modifies your genome.
Yeah.
Such that it would not have arisen other than the intervention of the hand of man to begin with. So in other words, these things are posing new problems in law, and let's extend it further. Suppose someone introduces, let's say, some human cells into a pig. This has already been done. And let's suppose the pig ends up at the slaughterhouse and ends up as bacon on your table. And you ingest some of this, and by whatever mechanism, unknown to us currently, this would introduce some sort of mutation or modification into your own DNA. Again, do you now partially belong to a corporation? Now, I realize in terms of the standard mechanism of ingestion of foods and so on and so forth that, you know, we don't turn into cows just because we eat ground beef. But we're dealing with things that are so new and so untested that I think we have to hold open the possibilities of things that modern science considers impossible. Otherwise, we're not really being very rational or commonsensical about this.
Well, exactly.
So, yeah. So what does this mean in terms of law? Well, the frightening thing for me, Henrik, is you see over and over again the courts, at least in this country, they seem to be taking rather a different view in Europe with the regulation and agencies over there. But the courts, at least in this country, have been siding with these corporations and against the farmers that claim, you know, they didn't want these crops. They were dropped on their fields, you know, by natural causes. And their own attempts to countersue have been dismissed. So I think the long-term portent here is these corporations could again take another step at striking down humanity.
Yeah.
In their decisions. This is what I find so disturbing.
Well, exactly. There's a number of different ways we can look at this too. You have things like Epicyte, the company that developed basically a contraceptive, you know, GMO corn, you know, and again, that's a real thing that changes the human being that's eat it. You know, in other cases, you have it changes, you know, the your gut. You know, there's studies on that too. But if we simplify that idea, that context, whether we're looking at a human being that is already alive or one that is not, if you take the basic building blocks of a human being and you modify that by 0.00001%, let's say, of the genome. The classification then by law at that point might be that that's actually a chimera of sorts. And it's that stage when you can come in and say, under law, then you're not classified as a human being anymore. And this would become the property of a corporation or maybe ultimately under the control by regulation of a government, you know? So there's a number of different things. Yeah, go ahead, Scott.
This has already, it seems, started to raise its head just simply with the question of the legality of something like Obamacare, not to tear open a different package altogether, but at what point is an individual forced to participate in something, and at what point is the body the personal property of the person who owns and lives in that body, and who can tell them what to do with it when it is not breaking any law? Well, if you begin to extend that reasoning, like, well, this is nonsense. Of course, the government can't force you with your body to do something or participate in something you don't want to do. Well, we're long past that point, aren't we? And so the libertarian idea, and I don't mean politically, but just simply the idea of the individual's right to exist and to make their own choices without doing violence or harm against another person has already slipped away. And if we extend that to where it is taking place with healthcare or with food, and I'll take it another step further and say even with education, where we are now looking at kids who are the perfect subjects for both government downloading of ideas, where even with video games that are interactive, and now they've already released in some of these early technology shows a cap which can integrate with the computer and with the games to where just one's thoughts can begin to control other things, which they're already doing. This, I'm not talking science fiction. I'm talking about what has already been produced in shows and shown to people. Then at that point, there is an opening for both idea movement towards the game or towards the computer, as well as an integration from the computer back to the mind. And once that happens, I don't even know what we begin to do with the idea of plagiarism when all information seems to be community property.
Yeah.
And so if my thoughts or my writings or Joseph's writings or ours simply become part of the community property or the collective thought process, then we also have lost the sense of property of one's own thoughts. Mm. And we have the technology to already capitalize on that.
Well, I mean, there are people who have that stance already. Your ideas are not your own kind of thing. That would just be the extension of that, right. Pretty much, you know?
Exactly.
Well, yeah. Let's look at something else too, Henrik, and Scott raises another interesting aspect of this. You know, the idea of the mineral man, you know, this fusion of man and machine that he's talking about. At what point would such a fusion cease to be an individual and become property?
Yeah.
Now, you yourself mentioned, Henrik, you know, this idea of 0.00, you know, X, whatever the coefficient is, means that you're no longer human. You're someone else's property. Well, we already have a precedent in the legal tradition of this country of defining humans in that kind of ridiculous numerical way, and it's called Dred Scott. You know, back mm-hmm. in the 19th century, right. Prior to the war between the states, you know, black people were counted as 3/5 of a person. Well, you know, for purposes of law and for purposes of census taking. Well, you know, that precedent is there, and you could easily turn to similar ridiculous lines of reasoning and conclude that, well, somebody has a certain percentage X of their genome that really doesn't come from any of their ancestors, so that part of them is property. Or person Y is wearing an implant from Apple or somebody, and they can only function, you know, in that capacity under license by paying a fee. So it pretty yeah. soon ends up, you end up with a society that you could be paying a fee simply to exist. You know,
yeah, exactly. There's no property in that regard, but there's right. a rent that you pay on everything, a leasing kind of yeah. of basic functionality of being human, you know. But it's
right.
And this has no end in sight, really, when you think about where we are on that scale already. It's just about, you mentioned, for example, that in Europe, things are at least at this stage, somewhat sensible when it comes to the GMO question. But when it comes to right. other questions like individual decision making and everything else, it's already very far, far, far down the road on that, downhill slope, if you will. And that could go really, really bad. I mean, that's one of the problems here is what both legally, of course, but also technologically, that structure that's being built, if that is taken over by machines or the decision making is left to, let's say, a few individuals who ultimately program those machines or those, you know, computers or algorithms, what have you, that's the real danger in this, when we have such immensely centralized yeah. systems that can be basically overrun or hacked or taken over by a coup or what have you, and everything in place could be turned against humanity, pretty much.
This is something that I've even heard on the interviews with some of the leading scientists in the transhumanist movement and some of the leaders in the philosophical side of it, which is to say, why wouldn't you have your children adapted to function at a higher place in society in terms of academics or anywhere else? And why would you leave them behind when everybody else is moving forward, when you can simply have this inserted, adjusted, adapted, put into them,
yeah,
and they will be able right. to compete with everybody else? And what would your children say if you held them back and they had the disadvantage? Right. And that is one of the strong arguments for the advances that are being made, which is, why would you choose to be subpar when you could be more beautiful? Why would you choose to be average intelligence when you could be, with the simply addition of some type of chemical or technological means, have a smarter child, because they won't right. function in a society. So this would be actually immoral for you as a parent to leave your children as average children in a world which has moved on past them.
Yeah, yeah. No child left behind. Yeah.
No child left behind. And it's the same sort of logic, Henrik, that he's talking about that we saw applied to the markets with high-frequency computerized trading.
Yeah.
If you want to keep up with everybody else, you've got to do it. But in the process, you've created yet another monster, and I think you alluded to that, Henrik, in your question, and that was that, all right, we have a few people at the top programming all of this, but the problem here is that, at least in terms of the markets, they have become so complex in terms of what's going on, that I doubt even the programmers themselves know really what they're doing
yeah.
and what the effects are. And this is the other downside of all of this transhumanist stuff, because take that and then apply it to human society as a whole. Do we really want to turn our fundamental educational decisions for our children? Do we really want to turn our investment strategies? Do we really want to turn our health decisions over to computers?
Well, sorry to interrupt, Joseph, but this is the very tenet of what people like Kurzweil is talking about. He's talking about self-writing scripts, self-improving computers and everything else literally would be out of control of human beings. In fact, they think that it's when this happens that the true extraordinary, revelation will occur, if you will, and humanity will be uplifted together with the machine. But that's not necessarily true,
No, I think there's a danger of another scenario altogether, Henrik. And Robert Heinlein, the old science fiction author, wrote about this decades ago in a wonderful little book. I hope everybody reads it, called The Moon is a Harsh Mistress, in which everything is being run by this supercomputer named Mike. But the problem is, all of a sudden, Mike wakes up and decides he's going to start running things the way he wants to without any input from these pesky humans. Well, I think there's not only a danger of that happening, I think there are even little tiny indicators that it might already have. So, on this score, I'm not speaking for Scott here, but on this score, I view this future with a great deal of anxiety and negativity. It's not the kind of future I want to live in. I like making my own decisions. Thank you very much.
Exactly.
I can tell you that in the field in which I spend most of my time now, which is in education, that the modern push is towards this computerized assessment AI form that it's heading into, and how to prepare the students for it and so forth. Mm-hmm. And so that at the local level, we were asked to design some form of assessment to prepare students to be able to handle the idea of critical thinking and so forth, which at least they're aware of the idea of critical thinking, which of course is for the last 20 years all been done through, A, B, C, D, E bubble tests, right? And so as a result of this, we're supposed to come up with something that is more like how the computer would work. And I hear all the ideas being tossed around, and Joseph will appreciate this considering our common background with our doctorates. And I said, here's what I do in class. I raise a question. I call a student one by one in the class and say, answer this question. They answer it, and then I follow it up, why? Or, okay, and then I take the devil's advocate position on it. In other words, I'm trying to make them work through the thinking process, right? And I said this in a group of other teachers whose response was, well, how would we use that as a form of assessment? How can you test students that way? It was as though I had a novel concept.
Wow.
And it was impossible to do. And I looked at them and I said, are you completely unaware of the fact that the oldest academic institutions in the world still use this form of testing?
Yeah.
Where they have oral exams and test a student not on the basic information, but from the basic information, look for ways to go deeper and discover what they don't know. But we're so reliant on computers, the concept in a group of teachers to say, we could do this like a computer could, they looked at me as if I had fallen from another planet. And they dismissed it immediately as a ridiculous notion.
So here's
where we are.
Yeah.
That a computer is considered to be a better gauge of an individual student in a group that has been taught together, as opposed to the professor or the teacher who apparently knows nothing about the subject or how to test the students who have been taught by them.
It's this idea that it's objective, it doesn't have any bias and, all these kinds of ideas. But again, someone is programming that computer and that algorithm. That's just simple ideas.
Well, let's look at this from another point of view and to continue the education analogy here. I once was asked to give a multiple choice exam. And I did. It was one question. and it consisted of 26 slightly differently worded answers, none of which were correct. And only one student, Henrik, came up and told me, "Dr. Farrell, you know, I'm afraid that the correct answer isn't listed here." And yeah. He got the A.
Yeah.
And this, you know, again, you know, how would you assess an American history exam that asks the question, "Who killed President Kennedy?" And then you're given A, B, C, D, E, and one of them is Lee Harvey Oswald, and none of the other answers will say a conspiracy consisting of.
Exactly.
You see,
exactly.
this is the problem.
Yeah. It's exactly. It's within, and even reality to a certain extent is defined within those constructs or that idea.
Exactly.
You know? Yeah. Wow.
Exactly. They're creating not only an unhuman world, but they're creating an unreal world. This is what I find so mm-hmm. frightening. It's a world divorced of any reality, and eventually, you know, I don't care what your arguments for advanced technology are, eventually such worlds collapse simply because of the sheer fantasy of the weight.
Yeah, yeah.
This is the danger that the Western financial system is in, and everybody sees it, and no one is taking any steps to correct it.
I think one of the reasons potentially why they might want to do this as well, to dumb humans down and everything else, constrict
sure.
them to very simplicity, has to do with the predictability. If it's true that we have
yes.
supercomputers that are basically running
yes.
assessments on behavior and what's gonna happen in the future or what happens if we do this or that kind of thing, then you need to have all these unknown difficult variables taken out of that equation, because otherwise we'll
yes.
never be able to predict what's going to happen.
Precisely.
Bingo. This is, Henrik, you've put your thumb on the hidden weakness in the kind of Kurzweil version of transhumanism, because in a certain sense, Kurzweil is arguing for precisely the situation that you've outlined, that Scott and I have outlined here, and that to a certain extent we've already seen put into place with the NSA spying, with their supercomputers monitoring everybody. In a certain sense, we've already seen this put into place in the financial markets, the various stock exchanges and so on, with their high-speed algorithmic trading. So we're looking at microcosms there in those two areas and in education with these coming algorithms and student-adjusted assessments and so on. We're looking at microcosms of the transhumanist future in general. And when we look at these microcosms, what we find, particularly in the biggest one, the biggest example that has public on record failures of the whole system and model, and that's the financial system. So again, I'm looking at all this and saying, if I had money to invest in, say, a company, I wouldn't do it through Wall Street or any trading firm, because they're not interested in the investment. They're interested in the fee and the price.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And this, again, is a divorce from reality. Just like you say, the supercomputers, they want to dumb us down to take the hidden variables out of the equation and make it manageable.
Yeah.
And again, that's not a human society.
And it has already happened right down,
yeah.
not only to the traders, but right to the teachers who stand in the classroom, who are more of managers than they are of actual teachers.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
And how, let's also think about this, how bad could it get when a system, let's say a system like this goes into effect in certain parts of the world? It might be globally connected, it might not be, but nonetheless, we have a kind of a surgence of something that begins to look like, I make the analogy of the Venus Project, you know, now and then, but people can, you know, take, there's other ideas out there of what could come into effect. But when a system like that, this runs into issues or problems and crashes, if people are dependent on that level
yeah.
of structure and even the technology
yeah.
of, you know, breaking your car for you, or, I mean, there's like an, this could turn into a depopulation galore event, you know?
Oh, yes, absolutely. Because humans would have lost the ability to think and act and reason for themselves, you know, and to repair their car for themselves or what have you.
Yeah,
or, basically, they're creating, in my opinion, they're creating a nightmare future rather than, you know, again, that's my opinion. I'm not speaking for Scott here. We were trying to, in the book, maintain a kind of strict neutrality, because not all of this technological wizardry that they're talking about is necessarily bad, but it is a double-edged sword, and that's, as you say, one of the consequences.
If your aim is also predictability, then in education, the key of merging technology and science and education would be to produce a curriculum which removes that aspect in education which is non-predictable, which is the area of creativity and imagination. And if you notice what is being done right now in the Common Core standard that is being produced from the federal government down, is designed to place an emphasis on expository material. In other words, reading historical documents, of course, chosen for the most part by them, which can easily be rewritten or chosen to slant in a certain way, but at the expense of taking out nonfiction to remove things such as Shakespeare or Shelley or Wilde or Whitman, you name it, you take out the ability of the student to think and to write at a place where the intuitive element is able to work outside of the box, right? That part that cannot be predicted. And if you take that out of the learning process at the earliest age, and by the way, this is now working from kindergarten all the way up through 12th grade, the same tests, the same standards, it is all the same for the first time ever. So you begin indoctrinating it at the earliest age, pump it all the way through until they're finished with high school and the computer directs them into the best place for their future, which I'm sure is coming. Wow. If you have taken out the ability to think creatively out of the box in an unpredictable way through drama, through fictional writings, then you can make a very predictable human who's only been trained how to put the right DVD on the right shelf, how to find the right application box to type their name into, which fills itself out for them now anyways. And there's nothing left for them to work on. If you ask them to write something creatively or to construct a poem, you might as well ask them what the life form was like on Mars 2 billion years ago.
Yeah,
they can't do it.
And think of another implication here, Henry. Imagine this system being applied to science.
Right.
How do you intuit or formulate an hypothesis and then conduct an experiment and observe the results? In other words, this system that he's describing and that you see some of the transhumanists pushing is actually a system that, in my opinion, doesn't presage greater progress in science and technology. It portends the exact reverse.
Yeah, exactly.
And, you know, Isaac Asimov, the famous science fiction author, wrote a whole wonderful trilogy about precisely this scenario, the Foundation Trilogy. And he describes a society that gets to the point of such technological sophistication that everything begins to be run by machines, just as you've described, and then people forget how to repair the machine.
Yeah.
So everything gradually begins to fall apart. And progress, while the machines are ruling and providing for everybody, progress comes to a complete standstill. And it's when things begin to fall apart again that progress begins to happen again.
Isn't that interesting? Yeah. Well, exactly.
Isn't that interesting?
It's okay, so creativity and fantasy, you know, going out the door pretty much. We're moving towards a THX type kind of future. But the main problem that we're facing today, I think, is that obviously, this is going to send us so far backwards into this inhumane world that it's going to be the road to hell kind of thing. But it doesn't define itself as such today. It's going to be more fair and egalitarian. It's going to be secure and safe and gentle, and all these nice words are used to describe this kind of system. And if you speak up against that, you know, people will attack you kind of thing. But as we know, the road to hell is paved with good intentions. And again, when you remove all these challenges and, again, the unknown variables, everything that's there to create the conditions for ingenuity and, inspiration and everything else, I think we have no idea, no comprehension of what type of world that the kids will grow up in, you know?
No,
I see it every day and it's frightening.
Yeah.
Oh boy.
Yeah.
What can so how do we fight this, guys? If it's about educating people in terms of like what this system, because well, again, many people are they're well intended, they have good intentions, they want to have they're doing this out of the goodness of their heart, you know. So when you again when you say something against this, it's like you speak against that, but that's not true. You're like, no, I'm concerned with where humanity is going to end up here, you know, kind of thing.
I honestly think to a certain extent, Henrik, we all have to become moderate subversives in our
I was thinking the same word.
That's funny.
I had a single word.
Well, it won't be the first time, my friend, that we've been thinking the same thing.
I was thinking Ingolstadt subversive.
So the new Illuminati.
Well, you know, we're in a way, I think we're serious, Henrik. I certainly saw these trends when I was a college professor and resisted them in my own classroom. It was just kind of an unwritten contract between me and my students, and eventually they understood what I was doing. And I think you know, programs like this, the possibilities for the human contact that the internet in a weird way enables, I think this may be the saving grace. And certainly, it's going to sound a strange thing, but when we look back at all of the secret society activity from the 17th century onward, it was often spread simply by informal groups of people getting in their coffee houses and drinking coffee and reading quote-unquote subversive literature and sharing ideas and talking about them. I think, again, that we're at that kind of place in human history. We have to talk to each other. We have to bat ideas around. You know, merely batting ideas around in such a culture as Scott's describing is already a subversive act.
Yeah, it is, isn't it? It's pretty incredible. But is this machine culture that's, you know, kind of arising mm-hmm. around us needs to have that dialogue in it to be able to balance itself. Yeah. Otherwise, it'll go south real quick, you know?
As long as there is a subversive within the institutions around, you will create, without even intending it, you will create that famous axiom, when the student is ready, the teacher appears moment. Yep. And mm-hmm. I see this with the honor students that end up in my classes or attend my clubs in poetry or other things. Their thinking is very far out of the box, and they have been batted around, bullied, and pushed down from teacher to teacher or from class to class or from social group to social group for thinking or raising a question that doesn't fit in the paradigm that is supposed to be adopted. And the best of them will rise up and say, I'm not going to stop, and they will find a way to express themselves. But there still has to be somebody that they can look to. And sometimes we have to look very far back, but occasionally there is somebody within their social circle or nearby that, whether it's through Facebook or whether it's through some other means of radio, hearing, email, whatever it is, where the world has become small enough to them that they can test their ideas, bounce them off, and move forward and pass that on. And I tell this to every class: if you don't do something, your children will be the generation that ends all things, because the apocalypse has started. It is yeah. over, and you better do something about it. And hold your books, read your books, teach your children, and yeah. you know, do not let the system just simply take them and suck them in, because I'm telling you, the product will not come out like what you think it will.
Yeah, yeah, right. Exactly. The right. 2045 initiative, Dmitry Itskov, you have the Avatar Project. There's, of course, just a slew of these in action right now, more or less. And what DARPA is doing and NSA, and between all these things, it's going very, very quickly as well, the development. But the main question that I have is, will they really be able to pull these steps off that they intend to do? There's because there is a big step between where we are today and literally having a, you know, a robot body or uploading a consciousness to a computer or integrating with machinery. I mean, we're far off from that still, I believe, unless they have something already developed in the labs that we don't know about. But there's a number of problems, I think, that's going to arise when this development begins. You know, these creatures will have to be on steroids not to reject the machinery. And but again, it's this trust that just look at the future and science will solve these problems. That seems to be the consensus right now.
Well, I personally, I think, Henrik, that we're dealing already with a two-tiered society in terms of technological capability, as you know. I suspect that for a long time that the national security establishment, breakaway state, whatever you wish to call it, has had technologies decades in advance of what we know. And I suspect that is true not simply of so-called UFO technologies, but also in terms of biological technologies, in terms of manufacturing, in terms of information processing. I think that they're far ahead of the curve from what people really realize.
Yeah.
So in that sense, I think that one part of humanity is already seen that future and is already living it. The speed at which they have been introducing and pushing the meme of 3D printing in society convinces me that this technology is much further along than is being let out. They're just letting it out for whatever reason. But I think, quite frankly, what is going to happen, and again, I'm not speaking for Scott here, but my own thinking here is that you really cannot heal an alcoholic until they hit absolute bottom. So in other words, you have to kind of back off and let them do what they want to do and let happen what happens. I don't think it's ever going to end up in a situation where nothing can be done about it to reverse it. Right. I think it will collapse of itself.
Yeah.
Because again, it's a society and a culture that ultimately is inhuman, and therefore no one can live in it.
Yeah. And that's going to drag into it, or the very existence of it is going to be like a rotten apple or something.
Yes, exactly.
It's going to begin from the inside, and when the human aspect is not there, the spirit of true rebellion, I think, is going to come in to upset and ultimately crash and destroy such a system.
Yeah. Looking at it another way, Henrik, would be to look at it like this. We saw the beginning, really, of the modern mechanistic, materialistic cosmology, really with Isaac Newton. And that cosmology has taken over most of the culture and most of the education and most of the institutions. But while that's been happening, science has been merrily marching on to other vistas. Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, things like quantum mechanics, and you know, there's just no other way of describing quantum mechanics in this context other than as a huge swipe against this whole mechanistic, machine, materialistic cosmology, because it just doesn't work. Okay. So, in other words, science has already moved along way past where the modern culture is. So, you know, let them create their machine, because the machine already has been superseded by the latest theories. The latest theories are already producing their own technologies. And again, that means the possibility that the machine can wake up.
Yeah, right. You know?
It will collapse of its own accord because of its simple inhumanity. You know, I love the story of the collapse of the Soviet Union. You know, here you had, of all the ideologies of the machine that ever took over, that was it. And one morning the apparatchiks woke up and they pushed buttons and levered levers and nothing happened. because the people were just not there anymore.
Yeah, exactly. They just walk away from it, and that's it.
They just walked away.
Yeah, yeah, and that's all it takes. You know, see, but again, as long as they keep up the kind of the propaganda, if you will, ultimately, that this is where it's at right now, and this is where people are, here's what it's going to be, you know, that people will kind of follow through on that, but eventually when the, I guess when the broken promises or whatnot, it's not going to be there anymore, then people will begin to look elsewhere for answers, you know?
No one, you know, the Soviet Union was doomed the moment that Stalin started conducting the purges and saying, you will do this, you know. And I look at the current set of politicians in this country and listen to how often both sides of the aisle are now talking in terms of forcing or compelling this or that action or policy or behavior on the part of the citizenry. Well, once you start down that path, you know, you're going against the fundamental libertarian trait that humans have, and that trait is we want to be individual, we want to be free.
Yeah.
And, you know, the society and the culture that these mechanists are dreaming, it's fundamentally, ultimately inhuman. It won't work.
And that's why I think the trick as well right now has been through behaviorism, through science, through education, has been to kind of try to breed those drives out of the human being. To get, that's the enemy now, really. All the things that makes you want to, you know, take care of yourself, basically, want to mend for yourself, want to do something in your life. That has become the enemy, and the pro stance here from them is if you become a malleable, you know, human being that they can shape and mold however they want, it's fine. You know, it doesn't matter what you do, just as long as you comply, kind of thing.
Right. Eventually, you know, the problem with that whole mechanistic philosophy, and I've said this many times before, and Scott's made similar observations, that these yes men, you know, with their Bilderberg meetings and their council on foreign relations and so on, you surround yourself by people of a similar outlook as you all of your life, and then suddenly get hit with something outside the box. You don't know how to respond to it anymore because you've prohibited the very thing that would permit you to deal with it. So, you know, you can't look to that group of, you know, the so-called elite anymore either, because they have no answers. And I think it's becoming clearer every day that they really don't have any answers.
It's crumbling, you know, it's falling apart in that regard, definitely. Now, before we begin to wrap things up for this time, gentlemen, Scott, is there anything you want to add to the discussion here, or things that, you know, that maybe something out of the book that we didn't really talk about? There's much more to it, of course, much more to the book. But what do you think?
No, I've had a fascinating time catching up on some of the subjects and really expanding them. So I don't really care to go backwards at this point. It's been great.
Excellent. Now, of course, these are things worth questioning. This has been very interesting, gentlemen. I want to thank you very much for an interesting discussion. And people need to read this book, of course, Transhumanism, A Grimoire of Alchemical Agendas. And then check out the follow-up to that as well, Transhumanism in Dialogue. And these are linked up both on your guys' websites as well. We can give those out one more time here before we wrap things up to people know where to go. Joseph, give us your site again there.
It's www.GizaDeathStar.com.
And then yours as well, Scott.
Shelley Unbound. Just like the author, Shelley and Unbound, UNBOUND.com.
All right. Excellent. Excellent. Well, thank you to both of you. Very, very interesting. We'll, of course,
thanks for having us on, Henry.
Oh, you bet.
It's great.
Pick up this discussion at another time. There's much more to talk about here. But keep up the good work, both of you.
Thank you.
All right.
Well, that's it for today. I hope you've learned some new things and have some new things to consider. A lot of interesting stuff. All right, I want to say thank you for joining us here in the member section, as usual, and for your continued support, as you are the ones who enable us to expand and grow in our coverage. My thanks to the Red Ice team, and I hope that you have a great week wherever you are, and we'll speak to you in just a few days. Bye-bye.